saying anything he judged would be effective in manipulating his listeners.
Chapter 4. It's often remarked that diplomacy is just warfare by other means. Our battles are no less desperate for being bloodless, but at least we get wine and finger food. Tollan Furlang, Imperial Envoy to the Realm of Ultramar, 564-603, M41. "Are you sure you're fit enough?" Castine asked, a faint frown of concern appearing between her eyebrows. I nodded and adjusted the sling I'd adopted for dramatic effect. It was black silk, matching the ebony hues of my dress uniform, and made me look tolerably dashing, I thought. "I'm fine," I said, smiling bravely. "The other fellows got the worst of it, thank the Emperor. In the day or two since the brawl with the heretics, my arm had more or less healed. The medicae assuring me that I'd suffered nothing worse than severe bruising. It was still stiff and ached a little, but all in all, I thought I'd come off lightly. Far better than Devis had, anyway. He'd spent the night in the infirmary and still walked with a stick. For all that, though, he was as irritatingly cheerful as ever, and I'd been finding as many duties as I could to keep me out of the way whenever he suggested socializing again. Luckily for me, he'd lost consciousness before the croot turned up, so my reputation had received another unmerited embellishment. He assumed I'd seen off our assailant single-handed, and I saw no good reason to disabuse him. Besides, the conversation I'd had with the creature had been curiously unsettling, and I found myself reluctant to think about it too hard. I noticed Devas's account had tactfully glossed over the reason why we were in the thick of the Tau sympathizer's heartland, so maybe they'd finally knocked a little common sense into him. Knowing Devas, though, I doubted it. "Well, that's what they get for picking on the Imperium's finest," Castine said, eager to buy the generally accepted version of events, as the latest evidence of my exceptional martial abilities reflected well on the regiment she led. She adjusted her own dress uniform, tugging the ochre greatcoat into place with every sign of discomfort. Like most Valhallans, she had an ice-worlder's tolerance for cold, and found even the mildest of temperate climates a little uncomfortable. Having spent most of my service with Valhallan regiments, I'd long become inured to their habit of air-conditioning their quarters to temperatures which left the breath smoking, and tended to wear my commissarial greatcoat at all times, but they were still adjusting to the local conditions here with some difficulty. "If I might suggest, Colonel," I said, "tropical order would be perfectly acceptable." "Would it?" She hovered indecisively, reminding me again how young she was to be in such an elevated position, and I felt an unaccustomed pang of sympathy. The prestige of the regiment was in her hands, and it was easy to forget how heavily the responsibility weighed on her. "It would," I assured her. She discarded the heavy fur cap, disordering her hair, and began to unfasten the coat. Then she hesitated. "I don't know," she said. "If they think I'm too informal, it'll reflect badly on all of us." "For the Emperor's sake, Regina," Brocklaw said, his voice amused. "What sort of impression do you think you'll make if you're sweating like an orc all evening?" I noted his use of her given name, the first time I'd heard him do so, with quiet satisfaction. Another milestone on the 597th's march towards full integration. The real test would come with their first taste of combat, of course, and all too soon at that. But it was a good omen. "The Commissar's right." "The Commissar's always right," I said, smiling. "It says so in the regulations." "Well, I can't argue with that." Castine pulled off the coat with evident relief and smoothed the jacket beneath it. It was severely cut, emphasizing her figure in ways that I was sure would attract the attention of most of the men in the room. Brocklaw nodded approvingly. "I don't think you need to worry about making an impression," he said, proffering a comb. "So long as it's a good one." She smoothed her hair into place and began buckling her weapon belt. Like mine, it held a chainsword, but hers was ornately gilded and worked with devotional scenes that decorated scabbard and hilt alike. The contrast with my own functional model, chipped and battered with far too much use for my liking, was striking. The holster at her other hip was immaculate too. The glossy black leather holding a bolt pistol, which also gleamed from every highly polished surface, and which was intricately engraved with icons of the saints. "No doubt about that," I assured her. Her nervousness was quite understandable, as we'd been invited to a diplomatic reception at the governor's palace. At least I had, and in the interests of protocol, the colonel of my regiment and an appropriate honour guard would also be expected. This sort of soiree was quite beyond her experience, and she was all too acutely aware that she was out of her depth. I, on the other hand, was well within mine. One of the many benefits of being a hero of the Imperium is that you're regarded as a prime catch by a certain type of society hostess, which meant I'd had plenty of opportunity to enjoy the homes, wine cellars and daughters of the idle rich over the years, and had developed an easy familiarity with the world in which they moved. The main thing to remember, as I confided to Castine, was that they had their own idea of what soldiers were like, which had very little to do with the reality. "The best thing you can do," I said, "is not to get sucked into all that protocol nonsense in the first place. They'll expect us to get it wrong anyway, so to the warp with them." She smiled in spite of herself and settled a little more comfortably into the upholstery of the staff car Jürgen had found somewhere. Armed with my commissarial authority, which let him requisition practically anything short of a battleship without argument, he developed quite a talent for acquiring anything I considered necessary for my comfort or convenience over the years. I never asked too many questions about where they'd come from, as I suspected some of the answers might have complicated my life. "That's easy for you to say," she said. "You're a hero. I'm just one of the youngest regimental commanders in the entire guard," I said. "A position that, in my opinion, you hold entirely on merit." I smiled. "And my confidence is not lightly earned." It was what she needed to hear, of course. I've always been good at manipulating people. That's one of the reasons I'm so good at my job. She began to look a little happier. "So what do you suggest?" she said. I shrugged. "They might be rich and powerful, but they're only civilians. However hard they try to hide it, they'll be in awe of you. I've always found it best at these things just to be a plain, simple military man with no interest in politics. The Emperor points and we obey, through the warp and far away." She finished the old songline with a smile. "So we shouldn't offer any opinions or answer questions about policy?" "Exactly," I said. "If they want to talk, tell them a few stories about your old campaigns. That's all they're interested in anyway." That was certainly true in my case. I was sure I'd only been invited as patriotic window dressing to impress the Tau with the calibre of the opposition they'd be facing if they were foolish enough to try and make a fight of it with us. Of course, in my case, that meant they could pretty much run their flag up the pole of the governor's palace any time they felt like it. But that was beside the point. "Thank you, Caiaphas." Castine put her chin on her hand and watched the streetlights flicker past outside the window. That was the first time anyone in the regiment had addressed me in personal terms since I joined it. It felt strange, but curiously pleasant. "You're welcome, Regina," I said, and she smiled. "I know what you're thinking, and you're wrong. I did come to think of her as a friend in the end, and Brocklaw too, but that's as far as it went. Anything else would have made both our positions untenable. Sometimes, looking back, I think that's a shame, but there it is." The governor's palace was in what the locals called the Old Quarter, where the fad for Tau-influenced architecture, which had infected the rest of the city, had failed to take hold. So the vague sense of unease which had oppressed me since we arrived began to lift at last. The villas and mansions slipping past outside the car had taken on the familiar blocky contours of the imperial architecture with which I'd been familiar all my life, and I felt my spirits begin to rise to the point where I almost began to anticipate enjoying the evening ahead of us. Jürgen swung the vehicle through an elaborate pair of wrought iron gates decorated with the imperial aquila, and our tyres hissed over raked gravel as we progressed down a long, curving drive lit by flickering flambeaux. Behind us, the truck with our honour guard followed, no doubt making a terrible mess of things with its heavy-duty tyres. The soldiers making the most of the grandstand view afforded by its open rear decking to point and chatter at the sights. Beyond the flickering firelight, we could make out a rolling landscape lawn, dotted with shrubs and ornamental fountains. Automatically, some part of my mind was assessing the best way of using them for cover. An audible gasp from Castine signalled that the palace itself had come into view from her side window, and a moment later, the curve of the drive brought it into my field of vision. "Not a bad little billet," I said with elaborate casualness. Castine composed herself, wiping the bumpkin gawp off her face. "Reminds me of a bordello we used to visit when I was an officer cadet," she replied, determined to match my blasé exterior. I grinned. "Good," I said. "Remember, we're soldiers. We're not impressed by this sort of thing."
"Absolutely not," she agreed, straightening her jacket unnecessarily.
There was a lot of the building not to be impressed by. It must have covered over a kilometre from end to end, although, of course, much of that area would be given over to courtyards and interior gardens currently hidden behind the outer wall. Buttresses and crenellations protruded like acne from every surface, encrusted with statuary commemorating previous governors and other local notables no one could now remember the names of, and vast areas had been gilded, reflecting the firelight from outside in a manner which was to prove eerily prophetic had we but known. At the time, though, it simply struck me as one of the most stridently vulgar piles of masonry I'd ever encountered. Jürgen pulled up outside the main entrance, halting at the end of a red carpet as skillfully as a shuttle pilot entering a docking port. After a moment, the truck pulled up behind us, and our honour guard piled out, deploying on either side of it a full squad, 5 pairs of troopers facing each other across the crimson weave, lasguns at the port. "Shall we?" I extended an arm to Castine as a flunky dressed as a wedding cake bustled up to open the door for us. "Thank you, Commissar." She took it as we emerged, and I stopped for a moment to have a word with Jürgen. "Any further orders, sir?" I shook my head. "Just find somewhere to park and get yourself something to eat," I said. Strictly speaking, I could have had my aide accompany us, but the thought of Jürgen mingling with the cream of the Gravelaxian aristocracy was almost too hideous to contemplate. I turned to the noncom in charge of the honour guard, a Sergeant Lustig, and tapped the comm bead I'd slipped into my ear. "You too," I added. "You might as well be comfortable while you wait for us. I'll contact you when we're ready to leave."
"Yes, sir."
A faint smile tried to form on his broad face before discipline reasserted itself, and he inhaled.
"Squad! Attention!" he bellowed,
and they snapped to it with nanosecond precision. No surprise that they'd won the extra drink ration this week, I thought. The crash of synchronized heels caused heads to turn all around us, minor local nobles looking mightily impressed, and their chauffeurs even more so. "I think we've made an impression," Castine murmured as we gained the elaborately carved entrance doors. "That was the idea," I agreed. Inside, it was exactly as I'd anticipated, the kind of vulgar ostentation too many of the wealthy mistake for good taste, with crystal and gilt and garish tapestries of historic battles and smug-looking primarchs strewn around the place like a pirate's warehouse. The high-arched ceiling was supported by pillars, artfully carved to mimic the bark of some species of local tree, and my feet sank into the carpet as though it were a swamp. It took me a moment to realize that the weave would form a vast portrait, presumably of the governor himself, if viewed from the upper landing, and I noted with faint amusement that someone had trodden on a dropped canapé, making it look as though his nose was running. Whether it was a genuine accident or the act of a disgruntled servant, who could say? Castine's lips quirked as she absorbed the full opulence of our surroundings. "I take it back," she said quietly. "A bordello would have been done out in far better taste." I suppressed a smile of my own as another flunky ushered us forward.
"Commissar Caiaphas Kane," he announced, "and Colonel Regina Castine,"
which at least established who we were. It was pretty obvious who the unhealthy-looking individual sitting on a raised dais at the end of the room was. I'd met a few good planetary governors in my day, and they all tend towards inbred imbecility, but this specimen looked like he should take the prize.
Like many of Kane's sweeping generalizations, this does contain an element of truth. The majority of planetary governorships are hereditary positions, and many of the incumbents aren't up to the challenge of the job. However, the truly incompetent tend to be weeded out by the ceaseless round of dynastic power struggles and coup d'etat, which keep the aristocracy amused. And in cases where imperial interests are directly threatened, we can always turn to the officio assassinorum.
He somehow contrived to look both undernourished and flabby at the same time, and his skin was the pallor of a dead fish. Watery eyes of no particular colour goggled at us from under a fringe of thinning grey hair. "Governor Grice," I said, bowing formally. "A pleasure."
"On the contrary," he said, his voice quivering a little. "The pleasure's entirely mine."
Well, he wasn't wrong on that account, but he was ignoring me entirely. He stood and bowed to Castine.
"You honour us all with your presence, Colonel."
Well, that was a new experience. Being ignored in favour of a slip of a girl. But I suppose if you'd ever met her, you'd understand it. She was pretty striking, if redheads were your thing. And I suppose the old fool didn't get out much. Anyway, it enabled me to fade out of the picture and go looking for some amusement of my own, which I did with all due dispatch. As was my habit, I circulated widely, keeping my eyes and ears open, as you never know what useful little snippets of information will come in handy. Although the main thing that caught my attention was the entertainment. A young woman was standing on a podium at the end of the room, surrounded by musicians who sounded almost as well rehearsed as our regimental band, but they could have been playing orc war drums for all I cared, because her voice was extraordinary. She was singing old sentimental favourites like The Night Before You Left and The Love We Share, and even an old cynic like me could appreciate the emotion she put into them and feel that just this once the trite words were ringing true. Snatches of her husky contralto carried through the room wherever I was, cutting through the backbiting and the small talk, and I felt my eyes drifting in her direction every time the crowd parted enough to afford me a view. And the view was well worth it. She was tall and slim, with shoulder-length hair of a shade of blonde I've never seen on anyone else before or since, hanging loose to frame a face which nearly stopped my heart. Her eyes were the hazy blue of a far horizon and seemed to transfix me whenever I looked in her direction. Her dress was the same colour, almost exactly, and clung to her figure like mist. Now, I've never believed in sentimental nonsense like love at first sight, but I can say without a word of a lie that even now, after almost a century, I can close my eyes and picture her as she was then, and hear those songs as though she's still in the same room. But I wasn't there to listen to cabaret singers, however enchanting. So I tried my best to mingle and pick up whatever gossip I could that would help us fight the tower if we had to, and keep me out of it, if at all possible.
"So you're the famous Commissar Kane," someone said, passing me a fresh drink.
I took it automatically, turning a little to use my right hand and emphasize the sling, and found myself looking at a narrow-faced fellow in an expensive but understated robe which positively screamed diplomat. He glanced at the sling.
"I hear you nearly started the war early."
"Not from choice, I can assure you," I said, "just defending an officer who lacked the self-restraint to ignore a blatant piece of sedition."
"I see."
He eyed me narrowly, trying to size me up. I kept my expression neutral.
"I take it your self-restraint is a little stronger."
"At the moment," I said, choosing my words with care, "we're still at peace with the Tau. The internal situation here is, I'll admit, a little disturbing, but unless the Guard is ordered to intervene, that's purely a matter for the Arbetes, the PDF, and His Excellency." I nodded at Grice, who was listening to Castine explain the best way of disemboweling a termagant with every sign of interest, although his retinue of sycophants was beginning to look a little green around the gills.
"I'm not averse to fighting if I have to, but that's a decision for wiser heads than mine to take."
"I see," he nodded, and stuck out a hand for me to shake. After a moment's juggling, more to put him off balance than anything, I transferred the glass to my other hand and took it. Erasmus Denali, Imperial Envoy.
I thought as much, I smiled in return.
You have the look of a diplomat about you.
Whereas you seem quite exceptional for a soldier. Denali sipped his drink and I followed suit, finding it a very pleasant vintage.
Most of them can't wait for the shooting to start.
They're Imperial Guard, I said. They live to fight for the Emperor.
I'm a commissar. I'm supposed to consider the bigger picture.
Which includes avoiding combat?
You surprise me.
As I said before, I told him, that's not my decision to make. But if people like you can solve the conflict by negotiation and keep troopers who would have died here alive to fight another enemy another day, and maybe tip the balance in a more important battle, then it seems to me that you're serving the best interests of the Imperium.
And keeping my skin whole into the bargain, of course, which was far more important to me.
Denali looked surprised and a little gratified.
I can see your reputation is far from exaggerated, he said, and I hope I can oblige you, but it may not be easy.
That wasn't what I wanted to hear, you can be sure, but I shrugged and sipped my drink.
As the Emperor wills, I said.
A phrase I'd picked up from Jürgen over the course of our long association. Of course, when he says it, he means every word. From me, it's just the verbal equivalent of a shrug. I've never really bought the idea that His Divine Majesty can spare some attention from the job of preventing the entire galaxy from sliding into damnation to look out for my interests too, or anyone else's for that matter, which is why I'm so diligent about doing it for myself. The difficulty, I take it, being the public support for the Tau in certain quarters.
Exactly, my new friend nodded gloomily. For which you can thank the imbecile over there talking to your colonel.
He indicated Grice with a tilt of his head.
He got so carried away counting his bribes from the likes of him,
another tilt of the head to the far corner of the room,
that he hardly even noticed his planet slipping out from under him.
I turned in the direction he'd indicated. A cadaverous, hawk-nosed individual dressed in unwise scarlet hose and a burgundy tabard was holding forth to a knot of the local aristocracy. Flanking him were a couple of servants in livery who looked about as comfortable as an orc in evening dress. Hired guns, if I'd ever seen them. A scribe hovered next to him, making notes.
"One of the rogue traders we've heard so much about," I said.
Denali shrugged.
"So he says, but no one here is entirely what they seem, Commissar. You can certainly depend on that."
But he was right on the money so far as I was concerned, so I exchanged a few more inconsequential words and resumed circulating. After a few more conversations with local dignitaries, whose names I never quite caught, my glass was in need of replenishment, and I headed towards the table at the far end of the room, where an enticing display of delicacies had been laid out. On the way I noticed Castine had managed to extricate herself from the governor's presence, and was working the room as though she'd been a habitué of high society since she could walk. The air of confidence she now radiated was remarkable, especially set against her earlier nervousness, but the ability to seem calm and in control, whatever the circumstances, is a vital quality in a leader, and for all I knew, she was shamming it as shamelessly as I was. It certainly looked as though she was enjoying herself there, and I gave her a light-hearted salute as our eyes briefly met. She responded with a flashing grin and whirled away towards the dance floor with a couple of aristocratic fops in tow.
"It looks like you've lost your date,"
a voice said behind me. I turned and found myself falling into the wide blue eyes of the singer I'd been watching before. Uncharacteristically for me, I was momentarily at a loss for words. She was smiling, a plate of finger food in her hand.
She's just a colleague, I said. "A fellow officer. Nothing like that between us. Strictly against regulations, for one thing. And anyway, we're not..."
She laughed. A warm, smoky chuckle, which warmed me like Amasek, and I realized she was pulling my leg.
"I know," she said. "No time for romance in the Imperial Guard. It must be grim for you."
"We have our duty to the Emperor," I said. "For a soldier, that's enough." It's the sort of thing I usually say, and most civilians lap it up. But my beautiful singer was looking at me quizzically.
the ghost of a smile quirking at the corner of her mouth, and I suddenly got the feeling that she could see right through me to the core of deceit and self-interest I normally keep concealed from the world. It was an unnerving sensation. For some, maybe. But I think there's more to you than meets the eye. She picked up a bottle from the nearby table with her free hand and topped up my glass. "There's more to everyone than meets the eye," I said, more to deflect the conversation than anything else. She smiled again. "That's very astute, Commissar." She extended a hand, slim and cool to the touch, the middle finger ornamented with a large and finely wrought ring of unusual workmanship. Evidently she was extremely successful in her profession, or had at least one wealthy admirer. I would have laid money on both. I kissed it formally, as etiquette demanded, and to my astonishment she giggled. "A gentleman as well as an officer. You are full of surprises." Then she surprised me by dropping a curtsy, an imitation of the bovine debutante surrounding us, the light of mischief in her dazzling eyes. "I'm Amberly Vale, by the way. I sing a bit." "I know," I said. "And very well, too." She acknowledged the compliment with a tilt of her head. I bowed formally, entering into the game. "Caiaphas Kane," I said, "at your service. Currently attached to the Valhallan 597th. Her eyes widened a little as I introduced myself. "I've heard of you," she said a little breathlessly. "Didn't you fight the gene stealers on Kefir?" "Well, I had, if you count hanging around drinking recaf, while the artillery unit I was with dropped shells on the biggest concentrations of stealers we could find from kloms away as fighting. I'd been in at the death, so to speak, and emerged with a great deal of the credit, more by luck than good judgment. It was one of the early incidents that had laid the foundations of my undeserved reputation for heroism, but my misadventures since had tended to overshadow what most of the galaxy still regarded as a minor incident on a backwater agri-world. "Not entirely alone," I said, slipping easily into the modest hero demeanour I could adopt without thinking. "There was an Imperial battle fleet in orbit at the time." "And two full divisions of Imperial Guard on planet." She laughed again at my astonished expression. "I have relatives in Skanderborg."
Skanderborg is the provincial capital of the smaller of the northern continents. Most of the action in the cleansing of Kefir took place on the southern continent, where the gene-stealer cult was most deeply entrenched, so Skanderborg and its population would have been relatively untouched by the fighting.
"You're still talked about back there." "I can't think why," I said. "I was just doing my job." "Of course," Amberly nodded, and again I got the feeling that she wasn't fooled for a moment. "You're an Imperial Commissar. Duty before everything, right?"
"Absolutely," I said. "And right now I think it's my duty to ask you to dance."
It was a transparent attempt to change the subject, which I hoped she'd put down to modest embarrassment, and I half expected her to refuse. But she smiled, discarding her plate of half-eaten delicacies, and took my uninjured arm. "I'd love to," she said. "I've a few minutes before my second set." So we drifted across to the dance floor, and I spent a very pleasant few minutes with her head on my shoulder as we spun around to an old waltz I'd never learned the name of. Castine galloped past a couple of times, a different swain in tow on each occasion, raising an eyebrow in a way which forewarned me of some relentless leg-pulling on our drive back to the compound. But just at that moment, I couldn't have cared less. Eventually, Amberly pulled away with what seemed like reluctance, unless I was succumbing to wishful thinking, and began to return to the stage. I walked with her, chatting to no purpose, intent simply on prolonging a pleasant interlude in what otherwise promised to be a dull evening. And it was thus that I noticed a quiet, vehement altercation between Grice and the hawk-faced rogue trader. "Do you know who that is?" I asked, not really expecting an answer. But it seemed my companion was well-versed in the intricacies of Gravelaxian politics. It came with performing for the aristocracy, I suppose. She nodded, looking surprised. "His name's Aurelius, a rogue trader here to deal with the Tau, so he says." The qualification was delivered in precisely the same tone of scepticism as Denali's had been, and for some reason I found myself remembering Devis's cloak and dagger fantasies from our night in the Eagle's Wing. "Why do you say that?" I asked. Amberly shrugged. The Tau have been dealing with the same traders for more than a century. Aurelius arrived from nowhere a month or two ago and tried opening negotiations with them, through Grice. It may just be a coincidence, but... She shrugged, her dress slipping across her slim shoulders. "Why now, with the political situation destabilizing?" I asked. She nodded. "It does seem a little unusual. Perhaps he's hoping to take advantage of the confusion to strike a better deal," I said. Aurelius turned on his heel as I watched and marched away, trailed by his bodyguards. Grice was pale and sweating, even more than usual, and reached out to pluck a drink from a nearby servitor with a trembling hand. "He's thrown a scare into our illustrious governor at any event." "Has he?" Amberly watched him go. "That seems a little presumptuous, even for a rogue trader." "If that's what he really is," I said without thinking. Those depthless blue eyes turned on me again. "What else would he be?" "An inquisitor," I said, the idea taking firmer root in my head even as I said it. Amberly's eyes widened. "An inquisitor? Here?" Her voice became a little tremulous, as though the enormity of the idea were too huge to grasp. "What makes you think that?" The urge to impress her was almost irresistible, I have to confess. And if you could only know how bewitching she was, I know you'd have felt the same. So I looked my most commissarial. "All I can say," I told her, lowering my voice for dramatic effect, "is that I've heard from a reliable military source," which sounded a lot better than "from a drunken idiot, I'm sure you'll agree," "that there are Inquisition agents active on Gravelax." "Surely not," she shook her head, blonde tresses flying in confusion. "And even if there were, why would you suspect Aurelius?" "Well, just look at him," I said. "Everyone knows that undercover inquisitors disguise themselves as rogue traders most of the time."
"It is indeed regrettable that this predilection has become so widely known. Personally, I blame popular fiction for perpetuating the stereotype, although it has to be said that some inquisitors are simply woefully lacking in imagination when required to adopt a disguise."
"It's by far the easiest way of travelling incognito with the rabble of hangers-on they all seem to attract." "You could be right," she said with a delicate shiver. "But it's no concern of ours." "Well, I couldn't agree more, of course, but that's not what my heroic reputation leads people to expect of me. So I put on my best dutiful expression and said, 'The security of the Imperium is the concern of all His Majesty's loyal servants.' Well, that's true, too, and it lets me out, but no one needs to know that." Amberly nodded somberly and trotted back to the stage. And I watched her go, cursing myself for an idiot for puncturing the mood. As you'll no doubt appreciate, the rest of the evening promised to be anticlimactic, so I drifted back to the food and drink. Our rations back at the compound were adequate enough, but I wasn't going to pass up the opportunity to savour a few delicacies while they were there for the taking. And it was as good a vantage point as any to enjoy Amberly's performance from. It was also, as I'd learned from uncountable similar affairs, the best spot from which to cull gossip, since everyone gravitated there sooner or later. Thus it was that I made the acquaintance of Aurelius, without the faintest presentiment of the trouble that innocent conversation would lead to. If anything, I suppose, it was the sling that was to blame. It had seemed a good idea at the time, but now I came to fill a plate, the damn thing got in the way, preventing me from reaching out for the palavine pastries perched on the opposite side of the table. If I transferred the plate to my left hand, I was turned awkwardly. My centre of mass shifted, so I still couldn't reach. I was trying to work out a way of getting to them when a thin arm reached across to pick up the dish. "Allow me." The voice was dry and cultured. I transferred a couple of the delicacies to my plate and found myself addressing the man I'd almost convinced myself was an inquisitorial agent. It was ridiculous, of course, but still. "Thank you, Sir Aurelius," I said. "You're most kind." "Have we met?" His eyes were shadowed. The irises were almost black, and had an unnerving, piercing quality that increased his resemblance to a bird of prey. "Your reputation precedes you," I said blandly, letting him make of that what he would. I don't mind admitting I was less relaxed than I tried to look. If he really was an inquisitor, there was a good chance he was a psycho too, and might know me for what I was. But I'd encountered mind readers before, and knew they weren't as formidable as most people thought. Most of them can only read surface thoughts, and I was so long practiced at dissembling that I did so without any conscious awareness of the fact. "I'm sure it does." He was an old hand at this game too, I realized. An essential skill, whether his profession was as it appeared, or as I had surmised. "You seem to have the ear of His Excellency," I said, and the first momentary flicker of emotion appeared on his face. I got in under his guard, it seemed. "I have both. Unfortunately, His Excellency appears to lack anything between them." He took one of the pastries for himself. "He's paralyzed with indecision." "Indecision about what?" I asked ingenuously. "Where his best interests lie, and those of his people, of course." Aurelius bit into the delicacy as though it were Grice's neck. "Unless he starts showing some leadership, this world will go down in blood and burning, but he sits and vacillates and hopes it will all go away." "Then let's hope he comes to his senses soon," I said. The keen eyes impaled me again. "Indeed." His voice was level. "For all our sakes." He smiled then, without warmth. "The Emperor be with you, Commissar Kane." My surprise must have shown on my face, because the smile widened a fraction. "Your reputation precedes you, too." And then he was gone, leaving me curiously troubled. I didn't have long to dwell on my unease, though, because the flunky who'd announced our arrival was back, looking a little flustered. He'd called out a number of names since Castine and I had made our entrance, but it was clear that this time he expected to be listened to. He pounded a staff on the polished wooden floor, and the babble of voices gradually diminished. Amberley's trailed away in mid-chorus, which was a real shame. The flunky's chest inflated with self-importance. "Your Excellency, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, Oran Shui Sasai, Ambassador of the Tau." And for the first time since arriving on Gravelax, I was face to face with the enemy. Chapter 5. Treachery is its own reward. Calidus Temple Proverb. One thing I'll say for the Tau, they certainly know how to make an impressive entrance. Shui Sasai was draped in a simple white robe, which made all the imperial dignitaries look ridiculously overdressed, and was surrounded by others of his kind similarly attired. There was no mistaking who was in charge, though, as his charisma filled the room, his entourage bobbing in his wake as he strode confidently across the polished wooden floor towards Grice, like seabirds around a fishing boat. I didn't realize at the time how apt the mental image was, of course.
The ambassador, like all Tau diplomats, would be one of the water caste.
What I did notice, almost at once, was the bluish cast of his skin, and that of his compatriots, which I'd been led to expect from Devis's gossip and the various reports I'd read. What I hadn't expected was the single braid that grew from his otherwise hairless skull, plaited and ornamented with ribbons in a variety of colours, which contrasted vividly with the plain simplicity of his garment. The meaning of the bizarre hairstyle sported by their human dupes, which I'd noted many times since our landing, thus became clear to me, along with the face paint the leader of the street gang had worn, and I found myself suppressing a shiver of unease. If so many citizens had been influenced so openly by these alien interlopers, the situation was dire indeed, and my chances of keeping well away from trouble problematic at best. It reminded me of something else, too. And after a moment I recalled the decoration Gorok the Croot had applied to the quills on his head. Clearly the races of the Tau Empire saw nothing wrong in absorbing the mores and fashions of one another's cultures, eroding their very identities in the name of their union. A notion any loyal imperial citizen would have regarded with as much horror as I did. I'd seen at first hand what happened when traitors and heretics abandoned their humanity to follow the twisted teachings of chaos, and the thought of how fertile a soil the warp-spawned abominations would find the Imperium if it were ever to become as unwittingly open to alien influence as the Tau and their dupes chilled my very soul. Shui Sasai's flunkies also had their single tail of hair ornamented, though slightly less flamboyantly, and I found myself wondering if the pattern denoted some subtle graduations of status among them, or were merely intended to be decorative. "Smug little Groxfondler!" Denali was at my elbow again, the words delivered through almost motionless lips as he made brief eye contact with the Xeno and raised his wine glass in greeting. "He thinks he's got the whole planet sewn up." "And does he?" I asked, more out of politeness than actually expecting an answer. "Not yet," Denali watched as the Xeno delegation made its ritual greeting to Grice. "But he's certainly got the governor in his pocket." "Are you sure about that?" I asked. Denali must have detected something in my intonation because his attention switched to me at once, a sensation I found mildly disconcerting. "You suspect he might be under other influences?" he suggested, watching my face for a flicker of reaction. "Well, good luck to him. A lifetime of dissembling it left me virtually impossible to read in that way." I indicated Aurelius with a tilt of my head. He was watching the exchange between Grice and the Tau diplomat warily, trying not to look as though he was paying it any attention. "Our rogue trader friend had quite a conversation with His Excellency earlier this evening," I said, "and neither of them seemed terribly happy about it." "You've spoken to Aurelius?" Once again, I found myself in the middle of a verbal fencing match. "Emperor's bowels," I thought irritably. "Doesn't anyone around here ever say what they mean?" "We exchanged a few words," I said, shrugging. "He seems to think the shooting's about to start." The bark of a bolt pistol going off echoed around the ballroom, and I dived for cover behind an overstuffed sofa even before the rational part of my mind had identified the source of the sound. I may not be a paragon of virtue, but I like to think my survival instincts more than makes up for any moral shortcomings I might possess. Denali stood, gaping, as the room erupted into panic and screams. Half the guests started running in no particular direction, while the others stared around themselves in half-witted stupefaction. Priceless crystal goblets shattered underfoot as drinks were dropped and swords were unsheathed, and every kind of sidearm imaginable suddenly appeared in hands on every side. "Treachery!" one of the Tau shrieked, glaring around itself and drawing some kind of handgun from the recesses of its robes. Shui Sasai was down, thick purple blood everywhere, and I knew from experience that he wouldn't be getting up again. The bolt around had exploded inside his chest cavity, redecorating the immediate vicinity with Tau viscera, which I was mildly intrigued to note was darker in colour than the human equivalent, something to do with the colour of their skin, I assumed.
The Tau equivalent to hemoglobin contains cobalt, rather than iron, so their blood and viscera vary from dark blue to purple, depending on the degree of oxygenation. Don't even get me started about the smell.
"Castine!" I activated the combi to my ear. "Where are you?" "Over by the stage." I lifted my head, scanning the room, and located her as she scrambled up next to Amberlee, who was gazing at the crowd as though mesmerized. "Did you see where the shot came from?"
"No."
She hesitated a fraction of a second. "My attention was elsewhere. Sorry, Commissar."
"No need to be," I said. "You weren't to know this was going to turn into a war zone." In truth, that looked uncomfortably like what was happening.
Practically everyone with a ceremonial sidearm had drawn it in a panic-stricken reflex, except for Castine and myself, and was looking for someone to use it on, which meant identifying the assassin would be virtually impossible by now.
"Gwela, animals! Is this how you respond to proposals of peace?"
The gun-waving Tau was getting hysterical, swinging the weapon wildly. It was only a matter of seconds, I thought, before he pulled the trigger, or more likely someone else shot him before he had the chance. Either way was going to start a massacre, and I had no intention of getting caught in the middle of it.
"Lustig," I voxed. "Jürgen, we're leaving now. There may be resistance."
"Sir."
Jürgen's voice was as phlegmatic as ever.
"Commissar?"
Lustig's was inflected with a query he was too well trained to ask, but I wasn't about to let the honor guard blunder into a firefight without warning. I was going to need them if I expected to get out of here.
"The Tau ambassador has just been assassinated," I said. Then I cursed my own stupidity. The channel wasn't secured, which meant every listening post on both sides had probably picked up my transmission. Oh well, too late to worry about that now. My main priority was getting the hell out of here in one piece.
Unfortunately, that meant getting past the Tau delegation, which looked like it was becoming a fire magnet for every Imperial hothead in the room. There was only one thing for it. With a curious sense of déjà vu, I strode forwards, my hands held out from my sides, away from my weapons. Please bear in mind that barely a minute had passed by this time, and the room was far from silent. Practically everyone was shouting at everyone else, and no one was listening. The rest of the Tau were babbling away in their own language. It sounded like frying grok steaks to me, but the gist of it was obviously, "Put that bloody thing away before you get us all shot." And the other guests were screaming, "Drop it!" at him and each other. I realized that with the tangle of competing factions and interests in the room, there would be a complete bloodbath the moment anyone pulled a trigger, which was probably what the assassin was counting on to cover his tracks. "Colonel, with me." Castine could cover my back, at least. I saw her slip off the stage and start towards me through the milling mob. Amberley had already disappeared. Sensible girl.
"You! You did this!"
The Tau struck the muzzle of his curiously featureless pistol under Grice's chin. The governor seemed to lose even more colour, if that were possible, and spluttered incoherently.
"That's ridiculous! What would I have to gain?
More lies!"
The Tau shrugged off the restraining hands of his colleagues.
"The truth, or you die!"
"This does not advance the greater good," I said, echoing the words of the Kroot. I wasn't quite sure what they meant, but I hoped they had more resonance for the Tau than yet another variation on "put it down before I shoot you," which didn't seem to be having much effect. It worked better than I dared to hope. Every Tau in the group, including the maniac with the gun, stared at me with something I took to be astonishment. Their faces are harder to read than human or Eldar, but it gets easier the more practice you have, and these days I can usually catch even the most carefully concealed half-truth.
"What the frack's that supposed to mean?"
Castine sub-vocalized into my combead, breaking through the crowd to stand beside me. I noticed with a flicker of relief that she still hadn't drawn her weapons either, which was going to make things a lot easier. "Warped if I know," I responded, before stepping forward to where the Xenos could get a better look at me.
"What do you know of the greater good?"
the Tau asked, lowering his weapon a fraction, but keeping Grice covered nevertheless. His companions hesitated, clearly wondering if it was safe to disarm him yet. Grice obviously thought otherwise, sweating more profusely than Jürgen reading a porno slate. "Not much," I admitted. "But adding more deaths to tonight's piece of treachery won't help anyone, surely."
"Your words have merit, Imperial officer,"
one of the other Tau spoke up cautiously, an eye on his gun-toting friend.
"My name is Kane," I said, and a whisper of voices around me echoed it.
"That's him. That's Caiaphas Kane." The reaction seemed to bemuse my new friend.
"You are well known to these people?"
"I seem to have acquired something of a reputation," I admitted. "Commissar Kane is well known as a man of integrity," a new voice cut in. Aurelius was edging his way through the crowd, flanked by his bodyguards. At a gesture from him, they holstered their bolt pistols.
"That's right," Donali backed him up, taking the initiative back into official hands.
"You can trust his word," which didn't say much for his skills as a diplomat, when you come to think of it, but then he didn't know me as well as I do.
"I am El Sorath,"
the conversational Tau said, extending a hand in human fashion. I took it, finding it slightly warmer than I'd expected. Something to do with the blue skin, probably.
"Did your friend..."
I indicated the Tau with the gun.
"El Hassai,"
El Sorath supplied helpfully.
"Did anyone actually see who fired the shot?" I asked, directing the question to El Hassai personally, as though we were simply having a normal conversation. A flicker of doubt passed across his features for the first time.
"We were talking to this one."
The gun came up to point at Grice again.
"I heard Shui Sasai say, 'What?' and then the sound of the shot. When I turned back, there was no one else there. It must have been him."
"But you didn't actually see the murder," I persisted.
El Hassai shook his head, a gesture I assumed he'd learned from his long association with humans.
"It could have been no one else," he insisted.
"Did you see the governor with a gun?"
"He must have concealed it."
"True,"
Grice's overly ornamented robes might have concealed almost anything in their voluminous folds, but I tried to picture this indolent lump of lard drawing a pistol, killing the ambassador, and palming it again within a matter of seconds, and fought to keep a smile off my face. "There are hundreds of people in this room," I said calmly. "Isn't it more likely that one of them is responsible? Maybe a servant you simply didn't notice?"
"Vastly more likely," Elsarath agreed, holding out a hand for the pistol.
After a moment, El-Hassai capitulated and handed it to him. A collective sigh of relief echoed round the room behind us.
"This will be investigated," Donali said, "and the murderer brought to account. You have my word." "We are aware of the value of imperial promises," Elsarath said, with the barest trace of sarcasm. "But we will make our own inquiries."
"Of course."
Grice wiped his face with the sleeve of his robe, quivering like a plasmoid and failing to recover a shred of dignity.
"Our Arbites will keep you apprised of everything we're able to uncover."
"I would expect nothing less," Elsarath said.
"We're in position, Commissar," Lustig said in my ear. Castine and I exchanged glances. "What's it like out there?" she sub-vocalized.
"Panic and confusion, ma'am. And there seems to be something going on in the city."
"Perhaps you'd better return to your compound," Donali suggested to Elsarath, unaware of the ominous messages we'd been getting.
"My driver
wouldn't get 50 meters from the gate," Castine put in. I switched frequencies to the tactical net, as I was sure she had, and heard a confused babble of voices in my ear. PDF units were mobilizing in support of Arbites riot squads, and unrest was spreading across the city like jam across toast.
"What do you mean?"
Grice quivered, looking around for a flunky to blame. Palace security troops were finally beginning to deploy, guarding the exits, although I didn't expect much from them if they actually had to defend the place. Lots of ceremonial gold armor, which wouldn't stop a thrown rock, and old-fashioned lasguns with the ridiculously long barrels I'd only seen before in museums, and which probably hadn't been fired in the last couple of millennia. "There are riots breaking out all over the city, Your Excellency." Castine almost sounded as though she was enjoying breaking the bad news to him. "Mobs are attacking the Arbites sector houses and the PDF barracks, denouncing the Imperium for the ambassador's murder."
"How could they know?" Grice blustered. "The news hasn't had time to spread."
For a moment, I wondered if my ill-timed transmission to Lustig had been the cause of all this. Then common sense reasserted itself. There hadn't been time to disseminate the information, even if someone had been listening. There was only one possible explanation. "A conspiracy," I said. The murderer had confederates who were spreading the rumor even before he struck. This wasn't just meant to disrupt the negotiations. It was supposed to signal a full-scale revolt.
"More lies!"
El-Hassai had been quiet for the last few minutes, staring at the ambassador's corpse as though he expected it to sit up and start giving us the answers.
"You think we sacrifice one of our own to seize control here?"
"I think nothing," I said carefully. "I'm just a soldier. But someone's orchestrating this. Emperor knows why. If it's not your people, then maybe it's some imperial faction trying to smoke out your supporters here."
"But who would consider such a thing?" Grice burbled.
I glanced at Aurelius, my suspicions about him flooding back. The Inquisition was certainly ruthless enough, and had the resources to do it. "That's for wiser heads than mine to determine," I said, and for a moment the rogue trader's gimlet eyes were on me.
"Our prime concern must be the welfare of your delegation," Donali insisted. "Can we get a skimmer into the grounds?"
"We can try." Elsarath was keeping it together, at least. He produced some sort of voxcaster from the recesses of his robe and hissed and sighed a message into it. Whatever the response was, it seemed to satisfy him and calm the others. Even El-Hassai seemed a little less jumpy.
"An air car has been dispatched," he said, tucking the vox away. "It will be with us shortly."
"And in the meantime, my guards will ensure your personal safety," Grice said, beckoning a few forward.
The Tau looked dubious at this.
"They were signally unable to do so in the case of Oran Shui Sasai,"
Elsarath pointed out mildly. Grice flushed a darker shade of grey.
"If anyone has a better suggestion, I'd be delighted to hear it,"
he snapped, grabbing a large glass of Amasek from one of the servitors, which continued to circle the room, oblivious to all the commotion.
"I believe the Commissar arrived with an honour guard," Aurelius said. "Surely a man of his reputation can be trusted with so delicate a task?"
"Thanks a lot," I thought. But with that reputation at stake, all I could do was mutter something about it being an honour I didn't deserve, which was perfectly true, of course. Donali and the Tau were all for it once the idea had sunk in, so I found myself leading a small gaggle of Xenos and diplomats out of the hall and into the open air. Lustig and the others came pounding up as we emerged, lasguns primed, and took up station around us. "Be on your guard," Castine warned them. "The assassin's still at large, so trust no one apart from us." "Especially the diplomats," I added. Donali shot me a sharp look, and I smiled to pretend I was joking. "I don't like it here," I said quietly to Castine. "It's too exposed." She nodded agreement. "What do you suggest?" "There's a shrubbery over that way," I pointed, blessing the instinctive paranoia that had had me looking out for bolt holes on our drive in. "It'll give us some cover at least." It was also out of the pool of light surrounding the house, less exposed to prying eyes and sensor equipment. So we scurried over to it, the troopers double-timing and the tower keeping up with remarkable ease. Donali kept up with difficulty, but managed to converse with El Saraf the whole way, slipping between platitudes in Imperial Gothic and the sibilant Tau tongue for what I assumed to be remarks too sensitive for the likes of us. Not that I had had the time to eavesdrop on their conversation, even if I'd had the inclination. Vox traffic on the tactical band was getting more urgent, the situation deteriorating rapidly. "The governor's declared a state of martial law," I relayed to Donali, who took the news remarkably well, only kicking two ornamental bushes to pieces before calming down enough to respond verbally.
"He would, cretin."
"I take it you don't think that will be helpful," I commented dryly.
"It's about as helpful as putting a fire out with promethium," he said.
Even I understood the logic of that. The riots on their own were bad enough, but putting several thousand PDF troopers like the ones I'd encountered in the Eagle's Wing onto the streets, itching for an excuse to bust heads, was just asking for trouble. And that was assuming none of them were secretly Xenoist sympathizers. "So long as none of the PDF trolls take it into their heads to attack the Tau," I began, then trailed off, unwilling to complete the thought. The notion of the aliens being forced to defend themselves, unleashing the war gear Divas had enthusiastically described to me, was truly horrifying. Because if that happened, it was credits to carrots we'd be mobilized to stop them. And aside from my natural desire to keep as far away from the killing zone as possible, I was by no means sure that we could.
"Our enclave is surrounded by agitated citizens," El Saraf announced after another brief and incomprehensible conversation on his own vox. "But overt hostilities have not yet occurred."
Well, thank the Emperor for small mercies, I thought, and stepped aside to talk to Castine, who was still monitoring the tactical net.
"There's a mob of rioters heading this way," she said, "and a PDF platoon with orders to secure the palace grounds. When they get here, it'll be bloody."
I listened to the traffic myself for a few moments, overlaying the sit reps with my still somewhat hazy mental map of the city. If I was right, we had barely 10 minutes before the slaughter began.
"Then let's make sure we're somewhere else," I said. "As soon as our little blue friends are airborne, we're leaving."
"Commissar?" Castine was looking at me a little curiously. "Shouldn't we stay to help? Help a bunch of gold-plated Nancy boys hold a virtually indefensible fixed position against a mob of blood-maddened lunatics? Not if I had anything to do with it." But I needed to put it a little more tactfully than that, of course.
"I appreciate the sentiment, Colonel," I said, "but I suspect it would be very unwise politically."
I turned to Donali for support, unexpectedly pleased that the diplomat had hung around. "Unless I'm misreading the situation, of course."
"I don't think you are," he said, clearly reluctant to agree with me. "In his position, I wouldn't be too happy to see the only competent soldiers in the vicinity moving rapidly away either. At the moment, this is still an internal Gravalaxian matter. Whereas if we get involved, we run the risk of bringing the rest of the guard in behind us," I finished, "which would be just as destabilizing as a Tau incursion."
"I see," Castine's face fell, and I suddenly realized that she'd been hoping for a chance to prove herself and her regiment. I smiled at her encouragingly. "Cheer up, Colonel," I said. "The Emperor has a galaxy full of enemies. I'm sure we can find one more worthy of us than a rock-throwing rabble." "I'm sure you're right," she said, though still with a faint air of disappointment.